Hello, my fellow climate warriors. This is Matt Myers, and welcome to another episode of Climate Tech Cocktails, where we grab a drink or two with best-in-class climate tech founders to learn from their life journeys, dive into bleeding-edge technologies, and have a laugh while we're at it. My guest today is Dr. Sarah Richardson, co-founder and CEO of Microbiome. You can find Sarah at The Germ Wrangler on Twitter, and also Microbiome on Twitter at Microbiome. That's M-I-C-O-B-Y-R-E. Sarah is a computationally inclined microbiologist and science communicator. She speaks charmingly to computers, bacteria, and people. Sarah grew up in West Baltimore, and after completing a PhD in human genetics and molecular biology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and a postdoc fellowship at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, Sarah founded the biotech startup Microbiome, where she leads a skilled and diverse team in the construction of genomic toolkits for non-model prokaryotes. In other words, Microbiome coaxes wild bacteria into becoming domesticated bacteria. Trained to straddle disciplines, Sarah has a very unique perspective on the emerging technologies made possible by synthetic biology. Without further ado, enjoy the show. Sarah Richardson, the Germ Wrangler, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's
nice to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be around, honestly.
We're here on Climate Cocktails, which means that we're drinking a cocktail of your choosing. And what are we drinking today?
It's called an orange line. My husband invented it, or at least, you know, with any cocktail you name yourself, you can say you invented it. But it's basically a Manhattan with orange liqueur instead of vermouth. Mm. That's the only substitution. And then garnished with, he likes candied orange peels. So it's kind of named after, well, out here in the Bay Area, the BART names its subway lines. I see, and you can tell I'm not from here because I called it a subway line. The BART names the routes for the BART by the endpoints, but colors all the maps consistently by a color, which all us East Coasters, I think, find weird because
right.
They extend it periodically, and then the name of the line changes. And if you're from out of town, you can't tell which direction you're looking at. You know, in DC, the orange line goes from point to point, but people say the orange line. So, that you know, transfer on the orange line, but you tell someone transfer on the Richmond, Millbrae line, they have to know where on the map to look for Millbrae and Richmond to figure out what line they're looking at. So yeah, there's an orange line out here, but it's not called the orange line. But back home, I'm from Baltimore. So I'm going to call DC my my metro system. Because people don't know Baltimore has a subway and it's only one line, the orange line.
I'd like to, you know, segue this conversation with a statement, which I think might be a quote from you, or if it's not, it will be. Poop is the new gold.
It will be. I mean, poop will be the new gold. Yeah.
Can you help explain why poop is the new gold?
Well, I guess part of my job is supposed to be to question orthodoxy, right? Why do we assume this is true? There's some things I don't need to prove to myself are true. And then there's some things when I ask people, why is this true? Or where do I look to prove that this is true? And they go, it just is. And that is a bug under my skin. So one of the questions I ask is, what is biomass? What does biomass mean when we say it in terms of, say, biomanufacturing or industry for fermentation, the way we make our foods, the way we break down our waste? And so in general, for a lot of people I talk to, biomass means sugar. What they really mean by that is there's some sources, organic sources, that we can turn into refined sugar. We can take sugar cane, we can take some agricultural leavings, and we refine that. And that sugar right. is now what we use to feed bacteria. But the biggest fermentation in the world, the biomass is wastewater, is poop. And we all have to do it for sanitation. Wait, everybody poops. So we learned that, you know, as four-year-olds or earlier, but all of that mass goes into these big containers that we kind of just sit on for a while and stir and just let bacteria break down. And the output there, we're sanitizing water. We're trying to make it so that we can recycle water and, you know, save ourselves from ourselves. But there's no other output from that. There's no other outlet except, say, maybe methane, which is sometimes captured when it's economical or when people are really determined. They say this wastewater processing plant is going to give off methane. But one of the reasons nothing else comes off is because all the bacteria who are processing our poop are sort of black boxes themselves. They're not well understood. So there's no way to get in there and encourage them to make something besides methane, which is totally possible. They make all kinds of stuff. But when you let it just run and run and run and run with all of them in there, just beating up on each other, because as each of them do their process, they're making the environment less hospitable to somebody else who needs to run. But then they die, and we could do better. We could do better. And the end goal of my company is to be friendly enough with bacteria that, because they eat everything on the planet, if it's organic, bacteria or what are breaking it down, that I want biomass to mean all of that stuff that otherwise we just bag up. You know, you mow your lawn, you get all the clippings and you bag it up, throw it away, or maybe you compost it, that all of that stuff is the feedstock for everything else we want to make organically and too valuable for you to just discard. And that poop is too valuable to just let it turn into methane, and methane is too toxic to our atmosphere to just let go.
I love it.
So poop, we need to make poop the gold. We need to give new ways for poop to become the input and antibiotics to become the output, or for polymers, for bioplastics to become the output. And that just means cozying up with bacteria because they can do it.
Poop is powerful.
Well, yeah, everybody knows that because it's the easiest way to clear out a room. But yes, the goal is to harness it. Harness it even better.
Correct me if I'm wrong. What you're working towards is to use CRISPR to domesticate bacteria to take something like wastewater, let's just say poop, and convert that waste into something that's very useful. Is that correct?
You're close.
Okay.
You're close. The only thing I would take out would be the CRISPR.
Hmm.
CRISPR is an overloaded term.
Okay.
So the famous CRISPR, right? The one that patents and articles and everything, that's a particular enzyme called Cas9.
Right.
And all CRISPRs came from bacteria and archaea. They all came from prokaryotes. Eukaryotes don't have them. So human cells, nobody has a CRISPR. But when you say Cas9, you're talking about one instance, actually. The famous Cas9 came from one bacteria called Streptococcus pyogenes. And it's one Cas9 of thousands that all work differently. But Cas9 is actually the minority Cas protein that you find in bacteria. It's not in the most Cas enzymes would not be called Cas9s. They would be called Cas3s or Cas6s because there's three or four different kinds of CRISPR cassettes. And by cassette, I mean a set of genes that has a function. So the Cas9 cassette, very recognizable, actually kind of rare in bacteria. And the Cas3s are way more important to bacteria. But cleverly, we don't really need to use CRISPR to domesticate bacteria. A lot of bacteria are super ready to come into the fold. I mean, think about it. Humans are friendly and we shed a lot of waste. Like poop is great. Poop is great to a bacteria. They're really close. They want to come in. You don't really need to import these super powered genetic editing toolkits. One of the reasons CRISPR is so popular and such a splash in biotech is because it really sped up mammalian gene editing. So mouse cells, T cell lines. It was a really powerful leap forward for that. But the problem that was being faced in microbiology was you couldn't edit most of these bacteria at all. Not even a little bit.
Okay.
That's my specialty, is editing them at all. If you can't edit something at all, you can't put CRISPR into it. So they could edit mammalian cells a little, which meant they could use CRISPR. But in my field in bacteriology, a lot of people would tell you these bacteria are not editable at all. And therefore, they wouldn't even try to put CRISPR in. Mm. I have a little pivot on that, which is I can make them editable. I can convince them to take up DNA, but then I don't need to use that famous CRISPR. If they have CRISPRs inside already, I can use those. And they're never Cas9. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So CRISPR is not necessarily a process.
CRISPR is, like I said, an overloaded term. It literally stands for clustered, regularly interspersed palindromic repeats, and it refers to a certain section of the whole system. And yeah, so we're just a victim of our own success here, just in people using the same word for everything. But I get asked that a lot, because CRISPR is one of those molecular biology tools that when it hit the public consciousness, it hit big. Like in the 70s, it was recombinant DNA and another technique for editing DNA. And that was big, and the public basically bit onto it the same way they bit onto CRISPR now, with the same concerns about safety, the same concerns about, who would own it, as with CRISPR now. And it got overloaded too. But yeah, a CRISPR, you might hear technically someone refer to a CRISPR system. But in general, I think when the public are talking about it, they're talking about that act of editing is what they mean with CRISPR. So it means different things. But your question was, what do I do basically? And I would just cut out the technical detail of what I use to do it and say, yes, I domesticate bacteria to bring them into the fold of cooperative species around humans that we use to mitigate climate change, and in a sort of granola way to say, to be more in tune with the biosphere, just like using goats to mow your lawn instead of lawnmowers powered by gas.
Okay. So how are you domesticating bacteria to mitigate climate change?
The first thing to do is to know which bacteria to approach. So the standard bacteria everyone uses a lot in synthetic biology is basically there by accident. We pulled it out of our butts. It's E. coli, is a human commensal. And we studied it for years because it's responsible for disease, and it's really close at hand. It's really close to our, not our hearts, but maybe our guts. And so it is good at a few things. One of them is eating sugar. That's part of why biomass has been conflated with sugar. What it is not good at is eating anything else. Why should it? It's been pampered with sugar for decades. It's kind of been tamed. So the go-to for a lot of these biotech efforts is to go to a cell that we understand, or we think we understand very well, and say, I'm just going to make you do something that's good for climate change. I'm going to make you eat something that I don't want around in the environment. I'm going to make you make something that I would otherwise get from petroleum. But E. coli is not good at those things. E. coli is very good at eating dietary sugar and making vitamins for us, maybe. And making us sick sometimes, the wrong E. coli.
I heard that you got an entire room of people to chant, E. coli can't do it.
I did. That was at a pitch day for Cyclotron Road, now known as Activate. Cyclotron Road at Activate. I did. It's been an important differentiator for how we're pushing our technology, to point out things like we're not using E. coli, because it's been tough for E. coli. Our goal as a company is to retire that bacteria. We kind of think of it as a dog. It's a trusty companion. It's been with us for thousands of years. And it will try. We can teach it to do tricks. We'll say speak, and it will bark. But was that speech? And in terms of biotechnology, if that's the only animal in your stable, imagine a farm that's powered only by dogs, right?
Right. That sounds,
you're not
like
going to be able to pull a wagon.
A rough place.
And that's kind of the state of biotech if you are looking at the brilliant ideas the researchers and entrepreneurs have. They have worthy goals, well-researched, well-thought-out, well-reasoned chemistries that they want to get to mitigate climate change. But if the only organism they have to act on these is E. coli, they're going to struggle. You can't feed a dog grass, and you can't even feed a dog meat and then expect it to make milk. It's not economical. You can't put sugar in and get biofuel out. The math won't work out, and the cell itself hates, E. coli hates making fuels. So your question was, how do you domesticate bacteria? And it's the same answer as how do you domesticate an animal? You first pick an animal that looks useful, that is already doing something that you're like, that would be super helpful to have around. So you're like have a dog and a bunch of grass. I mean, I hope a macrobiologist corrects me, but I don't know what a wombat would be good for in our barn. but the analogy holds for a cow. I see a wild cow out there and it's eating grass and it seems to make milk, a lot of milk, because its babies are really big. And I go, I want that. I could ask the dog to do it and the dog will try because it's faithful and obedient. Or I could figure out what would bring the cow into my sphere of influence. And that's the heart of domestication. And that's why our entire, this biggest success, our population boom, our distribution, the fact that we have a reason to need civil engineering is all down to agriculture and domestication. It's the best pattern in bioengineering. And so when I say domesticate bacteria, people get a little, how do you do it? Anyone can do it. It's the same as how you make new breeds of cat. It's the same as how you go get a wild plant and bring it into your garden and end up with delicious, beautiful, big, tasty fruit from a plant that was making tiny. You figure out what it needs and you encourage it to do the thing that you wanted it to do, that you scouted it for.
I think I've got it. What you're doing is you're going through a library of bacteria, some of which you're perhaps discovering along the way, and identifying what the bacteria could be good at.
Yeah.
And then putting that bacteria to work in positive ways, such as taking waste water and putting in bacteria that might be good at taking wastewater and converting it into something.
That's it.
Climate and commercially positive.
I think it's simple. I hope I can explain it simply, but yeah, that's it. We're lucky. We don't really have to go looking for bacteria that are useful. We don't have to go, it's called bioprospecting. When you go tramping through the hot springs or something and you're looking for interesting bacteria, people have done it. And a lot of interesting bacteria have been surfaced. Of course, one of our specialties is knowing more about them than anybody else does. So people will surface the bacteria and say, I found it doing this interesting thing, but they don't necessarily know a lot else about it. One of our specialties is using automation to really quickly find out a lot of stuff about it, more stuff than anybody else has observed. And then if clients come to us and they say, we're looking for a bacteria that could eat this waste stream we have, or we're looking for a bacteria that could make this polymer precursor we're interested in, you know, greening, we have our massive knowledge of all the bacteria we've observed. And we can say, yeah, there's someone in here for you. Or we can say, absolutely not. We've never seen a bacteria do anything like that. It's a fungal job. Or it's a plant job, because let me be clear, I'm not about making a dog eat grass. So there's a bunch of stuff plants are really good at, and we're not going to transplant plant genes into bacteria because the bacteria are going to be bad at it. But for us, that's our orthodoxy is no trans kingdom transplants. Not because you can't do it, it's just because you won't be able to scale it.
Right. So I watched most of the presentations I could find of yours online prior to this conversation. And one of my favorite slides of yours was a slide that showed a few different materials that we use regularly. For example, nylon being one of them. And it showed petroleum being used to produce these different materials. And then above that, it showed biomass also producing some of those materials, getting more specific that I think it was, you said that oat waste was actually used to produce nylon.
Yeah. They used to make nylon from oats. Yeah.
From oats, right? And I think that's really important.
Up until the 60s.
Until the 60s.
Yeah. It was pretty recent that they stopped, if I'm not mistaken. It was in the 20th century that they stopped making oats from nylon from oats. Yeah. We have a perception that chemicals kind of mean petroleum. And we even say biochemicals. But before we had a petroleum infrastructure, which was largely driven by national security needs to be able to move fuel around. And once you've got that, you can tap some of it to make chemicals. And they're incredibly subsidized because of that fuel infrastructure. We made everything we wanted to make, from plastics to medicines, from biomass, that wood had a great deal of value. And not just for a building, but for the raw source of things like plastics. And yeah, nylon used to come, they would get it from the oat processing factories, like Quaker Oats. Then the runoff and stuff would go straight into making nylon. Once you have that infrastructure, the motivation to do that biomass processing went away because the cost got cut out from under it. So one of our goals, it's going to be a big lift, is we have to have that sort of biomass infrastructure and subsidization. And to get there, we can't just say, hey, let's lose a lot of money doing biomass until we agree to build infrastructure. I'm obsessed with infrastructure. No one ever wants to build it, ever. We need another BART tunnel. We will not build it. We have to pick out the biosolutions at hand that will beat petroleum even without the infrastructure. We have to have some big wins. And poop can enter into that.
You look at so many different bacteria all the time. What's the coolest bacteria out there? What's your favorite bacteria?
They're all dummy cool, man. Like, they don't deserve to be pitted against each other. I guess one of the most impressive ones that really made me gasp when I heard about it, there were some people who were working on, they wanted to make a chemical called a alaterine. And a alaterine is a class of chemicals where, if you're at all familiar, if anyone's seen like a sugar molecule, glucose, it's got six carbons in a ring. And when six carbons sit in a ring, they sit kind of like a hexagon. They're very comfortable with that angular arrangement between the atoms. Mm-hmm. So glucose is pretty stable. Then you can get five member rings like fructose, and it's in a pentagon. And that's relatively stable. The carbons tolerate it. Alaterines are four member carbon rings. The carbon's at 90 degree angles, and carbon's not a fan. Because carbon's not a fan, that makes us pretty energetic.
Okay.
So it's an interesting kind of molecule that nobody thought a bacteria could make because it's kind of energetic. And I'm not a chemist, so I might be using the wrong words. But there is a bacteria that lives in wastewater, in very nitrogen rich, like basically pee. It lives in pee. Let's just call it pee. And it makes a lot of alaterines. And that's amazing all by itself. But then I always care about the reason cells are doing things. I kind of need to know, because that's how I can help motivate them to do or stop doing it. They do everything for a reason. It makes alaterines to protect itself from hydrazine, because it also makes hydrazine as an intermediate product in its metabolism. So it has an internal membrane. You might have learned in high school that bacteria are different from our cells because they don't have internal compartments. Like, our cells have nuclei and bacteria have nothing. It's not true. Lots of different bacteria have internal structure, internal compartments. And this particular bacteria has an internal compartment. It uses alaterines to make that compartment. And then inside that compartment, it processes hydrazine, which is rocket fuel. So this is a bacteria that you can honestly say lives in pee and makes rocket fuel.
PETA rocket fuel. Are you listening, NASA?
It's pretty cool. It's a tough bacteria to get to know because it lives in an environment that's so different from ours. So bringing it up from there and bringing it into the lab is a challenge. It's not an insurmountable challenge, but we lack some of the infrastructure that would make it easy. I call it the vendor bias. If I go to buy an incubator for bacteria from a vendor, that incubator will default to the temperature that E. coli likes to grow at. So in our lab, we grow some stuff that likes it hot, like 70 degrees Celsius. And E. coli likes it at 37 degrees Celsius. And I've had incubators that go, oh, yeah. Okay. Like the default is 37, but our range is up to here. And they just break when you get up there because who would know? Nobody's growing them up at that range. Or it can't maintain humidity enough in that range because it's just not used. The vendor bias says our fermentation tech trends towards E. coli. And that's a limit. If you try and go get the P. bacteria and you bring it into your microbiology lab, you're probably ill-equipped to treat it the way that would make it feel comfortable in your lab. And everyone struggles with that.
So you also found a bug from chicken poop that eats dairy waste and makes a commodity chemical.
Yeah. Like I said, we don't have to go very far. There's good reasons to stay home. And yeah, I think this was a chicken in Berkeley.
Oh,
I think it was Berkeley. We found it in a bunch of chickens. Because you don't just go one chicken and go one poop and, you know, Hail Mary. Right. I drove around to a couple urban farms and I went out to Concord for a chicken. I went up to Berkeley. I drove all the way out to almost Pittsburgh for a chicken. The chickens are unimpressed with me, but I was impressed with the size of their poop. I should have guessed. Eggs come out, the poop balls are going to be big too. But yes, this bacteria lives in the chicken gut. I think you can also sometimes find bacteria like this very, very, very close relatives. It's hard to say, to name a bacteria, if that makes sense. I'm going to be cagey about that we think in macrobiology, we're like, that's a rhinoceros, that's a hippo, they're easy to tell apart. Bacteria are not that easy to tell apart. We want to, we impose that on them, but they're hard to name. But a very similar bacteria you can get out of human breast milk. I don't know why. But this bacteria appears to live in the chicken gut, and our hypothesis is what it's doing in the chicken gut is a probiotic function. That the chicken maintains it there because it's helpful for the chicken's health. And it's doing that probably by killing bacteria the chicken doesn't want around. So it's a probiotic antibiotic.
Yeah, I can imagine this chicken in Berkeley was very well fed and probably a hippie. It's my guess.
Probably. I think if you're going to keep pets around or backyard animals, you kind of want to give them the best.
Yeah,
I think it was a well-fed chicken.
The chicken's like, what's the deal? There wasn't Burning Man this year.
Jeez. Bummer. So I just have to go back to the maize I got from the Berkeley Bowl. Now, this was a well-fed chicken, and the bacteria came out just raring to go. It's been our experience that when we go to the source like that, to an animal or to the soil, that the bacteria come out quite good at their job because it's a matter of life and death.
Mm. Speaking of a matter of life and death, let's change gears to the life of a founder.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I've been told that you are a very scrappy entrepreneur.
Well, I'm flattered.
Yeah. I was told that you're one of the scrappier founders that this person has met.
Are they calling me cheap?
No, because that's not. I am. It's maximizing efficiency, which is a wonderful thing. What is the scrappiest thing that you've done?
I don't know why my mind went straight to eBay. We buy a lot of used lab equipment, you know, just, and all of us in the lab are willing to get in there with a soldering iron.
Right.
Or write our own custom code to go around a robot that, you know it can do it, but the API or the GUI isn't doing it. We're like, we'll just tell you what to do. The scrappiest thing I've done, I mean, I want to give it to all entrepreneurs. If you say to yourself, I'm just going to make a company out of nothing, that's got to be just the craziest, balls out, wildest thing you can do is to impose your will on the world. And once you've decided to do that, I think the rest of it is in character.
Which means insanity.
I tell people, don't do it. Don't start a company. I think most people you run into don't want to, which is wise. And if they do want to, and they don't take my advice not to, you know, at least say no, somebody warned them.
Yeah.
And if they do want to, and they take my advice, it was going to be tough anyway for them.
Yeah.
And I'm save yourself.
Yeah. People watch Silicon Valley and Shark Tank and they think that being a startup founder is awesome.
I don't, Shark Tank did not make it look awesome to me at all. Shark Tank was inaccurate and artificial in hindsight, but I had to stop watching Silicon Valley. When I was still a postdoctoral fellow, Silicon Valley was hilarious. The instant I became an entrepreneur, I stopped watching the new episodes of Silicon Valley. I still don't know what happened because I think my husband's like, oh, let's catch up. And we watched one and I'm getting too anxious watching this. I can't do it anymore.
You got a nightmare afterwards.
I think it speaks to the quality of the show. as another anecdote about it, my husband works a Silicon Valley job. He's a tech bro.
That's good.
One of the good ones. It helps.
Yeah. It creates some stability around the household.
And he's in machine learning. He's good with algorithms.
Nice.
And he watched the first episode with someone else and came home and told me, I don't get it. It's, you know, a middling drama.
But then
this again because it's a satire. And the second time, knowing it was a satire, he's like, oh, this is hilarious. But I think that speaks to the quality of the show that it's too real. It's really too real. So yes, if you want to know what entrepreneurship is like, I don't think Silicon Valley is the worst analogy. But and they're scrappy. They're all living in a house right on top of each other.
That's
a little harder for us because we can't live in a house with incubators and centrifuges around. So we don't just write software. We also have to interact with bacteria. I think building stuff that we can't get from stores, that's the scrappiest thing we do. 3D printing and soldering broken stuff together and just our chain of,
Speaking of startups and Silicon Valley, what are three startups / founders that you love and want other people listening to learn more about?
I love Pivot Bio. The CEO is Karsten Temme. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I'm real bad with faces and pronunciations. But Pivot is an ag tech company. And they're all about plant health and they respect bacteria, which that's my low bar for a biotech company is they respect bacteria and they're doing it right. They're doing everything right. And Karsten's amazing.
That's their criteria.
If you're going to touch bacteria, you got to respect them. And Pivot respects bacteria. And I respect Pivot. I respect Karsten. And I think just the story, the journey, the tech, it's enviable. It's amazing. It's laudable. And I'm rooting for them every day. Yeah, I think they're doing really well. I mean, it's hard not to be also jealous of entrepreneurs who are killing it, right? Like, I love being jealous of them because they're doing right by the world. So one of my cousins, I always call them cousins if we share an investor. I've never heard anybody else do that, but I think it should catch on. We should be friendly. So one of my cousin companies is a company called Tro. And the founder is Vince Romanen.
I also don't know how to say his last name. So I just
terrible.
I'm like, Vince.
Yes. And Vince is one of the chillest people, which is totally appropriate because his company makes, I'm going to get it wrong, Vince, I'm sorry, plastic heat exchangers that they put into novel window units. So they're going to have an impact on heating and cooling and on carbon emissions, but also just on the decor of your house. Instead of bulky window units, mm-hmm. it's an over-the-sill unit that's more efficient and better for the climate. And the whole company is just neat engineers, just mechanical engineers and clever people, and they're doing really well. And it's just a great idea. It's one of those things where you go, why has nobody done it yet?
Yeah.
And it's brilliant and it's going to go far. And I just think that Vince is one of those people who really tries to do the right thing and is introspective, which I really respect. Having tried being an entrepreneur, that introspection I think is really necessary. And that ability to say, when is it luck that I am or am not able to be successful at this thing? When am I having good luck? When am I having bad luck?
Right.
And when is it something I had an impact on? You put yourself in the way of luck. But man, if you can't recognize when you got lucky, you're not going to be able to replicate your feats.
Right.
You're not going to be honest with yourself about what you did or what you didn't do to be there. And you're going to compare yourself to other people wrongly. And Vince is just so self-aware. And so I think also, like, I always say that my job is to be the second or third best company at the company. A person at the company to do every job early on. And I need to descend that ladder quickly. I need to be the person whose job is to sort of integrate people, but not to be better at anybody's job. And one of the other people I've met with that sort of philosophy is Vince, where he goes, no, I'm going to get someone who's way better than me to do this and learn from them. And I respect that. And I think another company that they're a cyclotron road company called Feasible.
Feasible. I've met them and I love their name.
It's a great name. Mm-hmm. It's a great company. The founders are just awesome. Their crew is awesome. And the tech is so cool. The tech is so neat. They use ultrasound to tell how good your battery is.
Yeah. I went up to them and I said, does this really work? And they go, it's feasible.
They're clever. They're friendly. Yeah. I really respect companies that like an ecosystem. I'm a biologist. So where they're friendly to the upstreams, downstreams, peers in the ecosystem, we all got to exist here. There's a place for all of us. And yeah, no, their tech works and it is super cool. And they're so collaborative. You know, they when we come out of Cyclotron Road, we're expected to work with researchers in the government in our vintage of Cyclotron Road. And they got tight with an ultrasound person who is using ultrasounds, if I'm not mistaken, to study earthquakes and the earth. Just so they're lateral thinkers. And it really just... The tech is so cool. It's important at every stage of a battery's usage. If you're the battery manufacturer, you want to know before you send it to the battery user, because the battery user who's going to then sell a composite product is going to get blamed if that battery's bad. So they want the good stuff from you. And if you're a home user, you want to know, is it my battery? Their tech is applicable up and it's just brilliant. And they're friendly and great. Yeah.
Very quickly, for those who don't know, what is Cyclotron Road?
Oh, right. Cyclotron Road is a really amazing branch of Activate. And all of these are fellowships that seek to take first-time entrepreneurs who are deeply technically rooted, but have never sought to apply that in business yet. And it gives them the chance to learn how to do that with, you know, maybe the rails up. Right. With some padding, some mentorship, some early therapy. Non-dilutive investment. And yes, oh no, and it's nice to be a part of, yeah. Because it is very peer focused, that it can be very lonely to be an entrepreneur or a founder. And so having people who are not, you know, competing with you, you're all in the program now and you can talk about what's rough. But while getting those crash course lessons in gap accounting, bookkeeping, how to write an SBIR, what a venture capitalist is and what never to say to them. Never tell a venture capitalist that you do great science. Science is a money pit.
Okay, hold on. I want to interject here. Speaking of what never to do in front of an investor, can we talk about that? We were talking about before we started recording, yeah. And I really want to talk about it because, not to embarrass you, but I want to help all the entrepreneurs out there feel more comfortable.
If they can learn from me, then yeah, they should. Yeah. I'm a communicator. It's my job to make sure that if you take nothing else away from everything I've said, it should be poop will be gold. And the one thing not to do to someone you're negotiating a term sheet with.
Right. What, which is?
I throw up on them. Whoops.
I think that's probably the funniest, like, investor term sheet negotiation story I've ever heard.
It was going so well. It was going so well. He took us to a nice little bistro. I think it was close to his house because when he called me afterwards, he's like, I don't know if I can ever show my face there again. And I had to say, I will find you another one. I promise. Or maybe you could fund me to start another one for you. But yeah, it was going well. And it's very reasonable. And they're great guys. The partnership that invested in us all. I'm really pleased with all of my investors. I struck gold. I have a mix of venture capitalists and impact investors and that are really on the same bandwidth about what's possible and what we should be doing. And that's really lucky and hard to mix. But yeah, we're just sitting there. It's me, one of my co-founders, and our investor. And it's like, oh, we're looking for this term. Cool. And then, you know, the food is coming and I'm just starting to feel like, you know what, when I get home, I might be in the bathroom for a while.
might find a new bacteria.
Yeah. And then it talks advanced and things are going well. And there's like champagne or, you know, bubbly to celebrate. And I'm going, right. I should go to the bathroom now and then everything will be fine. But then my co-founder got up and went into the bathroom and there's only one. It was a little bistro. And then I was like, oh no. And the investor turned to me and said something. I don't remember what. And I went, and just barfed all over the table. And I remember he did say, he went, oh dear. And my co-founder came out of the bathroom, which must have been 5 feet away. It's a very nice bistro that I don't want to, I'm sure they cleaned it up really well, but I don't want to name them. And he said, what? And I stood up and simultaneously a glass shattered. I thought it also knocked over a glass. So I'm just like, I'm sorry, and ran into the bathroom. Yeah. When I came out, everyone had their coat on and the owner was put. I was like, well, let me heat. And the owner's like, you should go home. So I did. And I was sick for a couple days.
The investor's like, I need to sign this just so I can tell this story at some point in time. Like this, this story is too good that, how can I not invest?
Well, that was sending a mixed message. Right. You don't want to risk puking on somebody to get them to sign a contract with you.
They did not teach you this at Cyclotron Road, right?
When I called Cyclotron Road to tell them what had happened, they laughed. They talked to it. They were like, that's a very Sarah story. Like nothing is going to be routine or regular with you. It can't be, can it? Like I did it on purpose. We got distracted because this conversation went all over the place. But you had asked me, you said you wanted to know what CRISPR was or, you know, just how it worked. Did you ever get that?
Let me state what I thought CRISPR was.
Sure, go for it.
I thought CRISPR was a technology to edit genes.
Yes, that is what it is.
Alter something in a way so that it is more ideal, quote unquote, than it was before. Like, as an example, we could use CRISPR to, in a perfect world, ensure that Matt doesn't get pancreatic cancer.
We can say that in a perfect world. I would say that outcome is unlikely in any proximal world.
Okay.
If you are already a grown adult, it's going to be hard to edit you. In a perfect world, yes, CRISPR is a tool that we use to edit genes. Yep. If is that all you wanted to know about it? Because you've got that. That's right.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
My spin on the story is which were bacterial focused, because bacteria invented this and they don't get enough credit.
Bacteria invented what?
CRISPR.
CRISPR. Right.
Yeah. So you'll hear a lot of people talk about how CRISPR is an immune system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a good analogy. I would call it more of a spam filter.
A spam filter. CRISPR is a spam.
Yeah.
Filter. Okay.
It's a spam filter. And the way you use it to edit is you basically add things to the do not call list or the block list.
Pancreatic cancer filter you out.
The genes the alleles, the DNA sequence associated with cancer, put it on the block list. And then when you sit CRISPR on it, it goes, well, none of this can exist anymore, and cuts it. And in bacteria, yeah, that's how it works. They basically came up with a way to pass do not call lists, or sorry, I keep saying do not call, it should be block lists, onto their children, which humans can't do.
Okay.
All the immunity you get in your lifetime, you are not going to pass on to your offspring.
Right.
But bacteria can pass it on. And that's clever. And I don't think appreciated enough about the origins of CRISPR is bacteria just being real good at living on this planet.
Is CRISPR, it's getting real deep. Is CRISPR playing God?
So I don't like the analogies that get used a lot in synthetic biology about control and design, and mainly because it's not actually true. I mean, everyone learned in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. It is not controllable. It is not designable. And therefore, we literally cannot play God because it is not coming out the way we envisioned. Mm. We cannot program life. DNA is not a programming language. Cells are not computers.
Mm.
That's one of the, I mean, if you do both, the computer is a lot easier to get to do what you want than a cell is. That's why we use the analogy for domestication. It's cooperation within each organism's skill set. So was it playing God to domesticate the dog?
Maybe, you know, like these dogs were meant to roam free, and we decided that we wanted to have them as pets and ultimately make Instagram friendly photos and videos of them.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of pugs or French bulldogs or anything, but I respect where everyone wants to draw that line. I just want to make sure that we are using the same language and talking about the same thing when we draw the line. So if someone does feel that domesticating organisms from the wild, bringing them into like a human orbit, and altering them, because domestication does require alteration on both sides. It's a compromise. Humans change and dogs change. We learned how to communicate with each other. We learned what each other needed, and we changed our behaviors accordingly. So it happens on both sides. Where that the analogy of playing God, control and design, is all take and no give. It's just not how biology works. So even if we were playing God and controlling a cell, you know, functionally, we would change because of the presence of that life and the way it works. But if people want to say, you know, that's where I'm drawing the line, is domestication of the dog, and that's playing God, we shouldn't have done it. Well, then what I'm doing might be considered on the same side of the line. What I do not do is make cells do things they've never done before. Nobody on this planet can invent a gene out of nothing. All genes that get moved around, get studied, they're all from living things. They were all already here on this planet, evolved before a scientist ever touched them. So I think if you're worried about someone playing God and you talk to them and they're like, yes, I'm going to design this, the cells are just going to do what I tell them to, they're not going to succeed. And they are approaching biology with the wrong attitude, the wrong philosophy. But if they say, hey, this bug really enjoys this animal really likes it.
It's almost dangerous, right? Or it can be dangerous.
I don't see a lot of danger in it, just because usually what they're trying to do is pretty self-correcting. Yeah. The worst damages humans have done to the planet have not been through genetic engineering. Just moving an organism from a place where it is well-balanced with its ecosystem, has predators and prey, to an ecosystem where it has no predators. We do this over and over and over again. And that is more damaging to our ecosystems and to climate than any gene manipulation we've ever done. The risks are real, but they must be compared to the rewards. And I don't think it's fair to not be assessing the other biotasks we undertake, or assuming that because they don't involve genetic manipulation, because they only involve ecosystem manipulation, that they're somehow inherently safer or less, I don't want to say playing God, but just short-sighted. Mm. So moving carp from Asia to our waterways, moving mussels, all of the ballast water, moving kudzu to the plants taking over along the verges and the highways. These were all massive ecosystem rearrangements we perpetrated for reasons. Bringing starlings to America. Massive damage from a place where they existed basically okay, and then bringing them over here. Cats, oh my God. Everyone who lets their cat out in the morning to just go hunt birds for fun and then brings them back in the afternoon to eat. No, that is... These are really bad sins against our ecosystem, if you care. And I think that's been way more dangerous over time to humans and to other animals and plants and our ecosystem than the stuff that we've done with genetic engineering, which I'm not advocating not looking at, but I do want to put into context. If you think you can control a cell, you're going to ask it to do something it can't do. It's not going to do it just because you wanted it to or thought you envisioned the DNA properly. It's not going to happen. You are way less dangerous than anyone thinks you are.
Synopsis, keep your cats indoors. Okay.
Keep your cats indoors. I'm sorry, but I think maybe cats haven't been domesticated well enough. If you think your cat can't exist without unsupervised time outside, free range, we should be moving towards animals that are content in the house, or we should not have them. It's a bad fit. It's not a useful animal. But yeah, no, the studies on the damage cats do to the environment, it's staggering. It's staggering.
Really?
And
really?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I had a dog door and one of my cats used to go out and he'd bring back hummingbirds, and, you know, two hummingbird bodies later, he's a criminal for life. I upgraded the dog door so he cannot get out of it. I didn't think he was going out the dog door, or I thought he was staying in the yard, but no, not happening. I'm not having that on my conscience.
Yeah, it's like they need to make a Netflix serial killer documentary about that cat.
My cat is a criminal. And yeah. They've done studies. I think you can go watch video where they put cameras around the necks of well-fed house cats and watch as they just went on four fun killing sprees. The death toll is insane. But they're charismatic megafauna. So nobody sees like a cat sitting out, you know, in a backyard as a threat. It's cute. It's domestic. Nah. They're serial killers. They're damaging the ecosystem.
You know what? I think you could probably tell dog lovers that cats are serial killers and they'll be just fine with that.
Yeah, no, I think even the cat owners are like, yeah, but it's cute. He's so cute when he pops his little murder mittens and just shreds something. Just he's practicing for when I let him out later. I mean, I have cats. I get it. But you have to understand your organism. If you're going to domesticate anything, if you're going to be a microbiologist, if you're going to be a bioengineer, you have to understand your organism. I understand cats are still killers. Mm. We haven't been able to take that out of them. And if we're going to keep them around and domesticate them, we should maybe consider that we should really focus on the ones that are willing to stay indoors and only simulate murder as opposed to like feel the need to get out there and get the fresh blood in their maw.
Well, I can't wait till we can actually hang out, you know, post apocalyptic pandemic. And I want to meet your cat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I always name my cats after mathematicians because they're they have a reputation. Well, the one I was talking about is Werder. His name is Paul Erdős, after the Hungarian mathematician who was a meth head.
Oh, really?
Because when this cat was a kitten, he just bounced off the walls. Which part, really?
Wait, the meth head? They had meth heads back in the day?
I don't know how back in the day you would consider Paul Erdős. He was alive from 1913 to 1996. But he had a habit. Have you heard of an Erdős number?
No.
A lot of the mathematicians I know are very interested in lineage. So they'll tell you which school of thought. But mathematicians can track each other by an Erdős number, which is basically how close you were to publishing a paper with Paul Erdős. So if you have an Erdős number of 1, you co-published with Erdős. And if you have a number of 2, you co-published with someone who published with Erdős. It's because he was insanely brilliant and influential, but he had a really bad habit of, if he thought you were doing good math, he'd show up at your house and move in for a while, and you'd do great math together, and everyone would be miserable living with him because he was doing amphetamines constantly. And then, you know, you'd publish a brilliant paper, and he'd bounce to the next house, and your partner would be like, never again. I don't care about your career anymore. So somebody once challenged him to stop doing drugs for a month because they were worried about him. And so he did. He stopped doing drugs for a month. And then he told that person, you have just retarded the progress of math by 30 days, and went right back to doing the drugs. So I named this cat after him because this cat is bounce off the walls, terrible house guest when he was a kitten, just bite your feet while you were asleep. Just, you know, you want to kick him out of the house, but then he might go kill a bird.
He sounds kind of like 3 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, exactly. That's how Erdős numbers work. Okay. Yep. So we got another cat, and that cat's name is Andre Semeretti, okay. who has an Erdős number of 1.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, your cats are smart.
No. Semeretti, we call him Reddy. He's effective. How about that? I don't think he's smart. I think he's effective at being a cat. If you ask my husband, he's like, they don't have to be smart. They're good at cuddles. So,
well, on that note, I don't know a great place to end, but that might just have to be it, because you know what, we're just like kindred spirits, and I think we could continue to, you know, drink orange lines and.
I didn't ask, how do you like the orange line?
The orange line is terrific because I really like oranges and citrus in general. It's really good. If people could see the video, I've been continuing to drink it. So it's very nice. Although I don't have the candied orange peel, unfortunately. That'll be what
you're on the peninsula, right?
No, I am in the city of San Francisco.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I bet the Rainbow Grocery would have them.
All right, I'll have to go there. I have actually.
They'll be in a little right like little deli tub, candied oranges, a candied orange peel. Yeah,
great.
Wherever you would go find candied ginger or something in the store, that's where you'd find it.
Absolutely. Well, we'll just maybe continue this conversation a little bit offline. It's great. I love being structured, but this has been fantastic. I feel like we've covered so many things here. I mean.
It does feel like we bounced around a lot. No, it was fun. You always do a good job of finding people who are not just interesting but also tolerable to be around. In my experience, so whenever you're like, "Hey, let's go hang out here" or "Let's go do this thing," I am very inclined to do it because the people you curate and collect have always been an honor to meet. So I'm honored to be among them. If you think I'm good enough to like drop into a party, I'm feeling pretty flattered.
We're going to have a lot of parties after we're all vaccinated.
It's going to be the roaring 20s. Yeah. Thanks.
Oh my God.
I'll be there.
Jeez. It's going to be Bay Area social everywhere. Thank you so much for joining this podcast. I greatly appreciate it, Sarah. And I'll see you soon. Have a lovely rest of the week and weekend.
Thank you. Oh yeah. Oh, one more day to go. Yes. Yes. It'll be lovely to hit Saturday. It will.
Thank you so much for listening. The resources that we mentioned and everything else we talked about, drink recipes, various people, companies, so on and so forth, will all be linked in the show notes on our Substack at climatetechcocktails.substack.com. If you want to write us, our email address is m@climatetechcocktails.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at @CT_cocktails and on Instagram, #climatetechcocktails. You can reach me personally by carrier pigeon or on my LinkedIn /Matthew J. Myers. Until next time, keep the dream alive and do your part to make the world a better place for 100% of humanity. And thanks for tuning in.